Daniel Bergner felt frustrated and helpless back when one of his closest family members, his brother, was diagnosed with a serious mental illness. He also wondered about the psychiatric treatment his sibling was getting. It almost always centered on heavy-duty medications that could be dangerous, but also ineffective. So Bergner, who's an author, decided to report on other possibilities for his brother's healing, and also new chances for his brother's, and thus his own, life. Charles Monroe Kane, who's experienced parts of the brother's dilemma himself, talked with Bergner.
If COVID has taught me anything, or taught us anything, and I'm not sure in America it has, but is that the healthcare system just generally is broken. But it also seems that even more broken is the mental healthcare system. There must have been a moment in your life where you were like, ding, this is a mess.
So I'd say there were two moments. One was back when my brother and I were in our early 20s, diagnosed as he was severely bipolar. He was put on a locked ward. Our parents told he would well take his own life if he didn't stick to medication. That didn't sit easily for me. It wasn't that I was rejecting all that our parents said and all that the psychiatrist said, but it just seemed too simple, too straightforward for this thing that is our minds, ourselves, our psyches. And then I guess when my brother and I talked about our embarking on this project much more recently, a few years ago, top end elite researchers told me again and again, we haven't made progress in our psychiatric medications in half a century. But meanwhile, practitioners are doling out psychiatric drugs at increasing rates and doling out psychiatric diagnoses at increasing rates. For instance, for kids, bipolar, recent decade, increase in that diagnosis 40-fold.
Wow.
So something was clearly amiss. And I'm talking constantly with really compassionate, thoughtful psychiatric researchers. And yet, somehow, we're missing the individual in the way we think about mental health. And I think when you talk about a mess, that's the source of the mess. We're not seeing the human being in a full way.
Well, speaking of the individual, we're sitting here talking about economics, but we're also talking about your brother. What was it like growing up with him? I mean, what's he like?
Amazing musician, really creative artist, also a dancer when he was young, and ambitious. And the side effects of the drugs prevented him from playing at the level that he was used to and with the nuance that he was used to. So a few years down the line, after adhering to what the psychiatrists were telling him, he went off the medication against advice. And yes, there were dark moments. He was arrested. He was put back on a locked ward. He was homeless for a while. And that was a really, really trying time. But the truth is, flash forward, he's lived a really flourishing, meaningful life. That in itself raises questions about that doctrine that said, take your medication, here's your diagnosis, here's who you are permanently.
Yes.
There was no permanence to this.
Well, I'll just say for myself, and I know a lot of our listeners know me, know this, is that I, when I was young, I was diagnosed with schizophrenia that was later diagnosed as bipolar 1. Somehow that was a celebration. I have taken so many meds, Daniel, like just boatloads of combinations of meds. I've had so much therapy, so much psychiatry. I've been hospitalized a number of times, unfortunately, some of them not voluntary. During all that, I would go to group therapy. And I will say I love group therapy. I find it to be powerful. I find it to be useful. Like right now, I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. The folks in my group therapy right here, they're a mess. And I'm not just a mess mentally as they're trying to figure stuff out. I mean, their lives are a mess. They're often just divorced, addicted, but also a lot of them are on the border of homelessness. One is homeless. They're 40 years old and still living with their mom. One woman's selling her body. When I observe them and I observe their mental illness, the side effects and how it affects them economically is worse than the mental illness.
Right. And indeed, 30 to 60% of those who are prescribed antipsychotics walk away from them. Conventional psychiatry would say that's because they're disorganized, that's because they don't acknowledge they're ill, et cetera, et cetera. I want to say maybe we ought to look at this as they're voting with their feet. And on balance, they're making a rational choice. Now, again, you probably know this all too well. If you've got that diagnosis of schizophrenia or anything on that psychosis spectrum, practitioners are likely to doubt that you can make a rational decision.
Yeah, but they don't talk to you at all.
Exactly. But over and over, what I found is even when people are in crisis, even when they are engulfed in a, let's call it an alternate reality, if I'm willing to sit there and listen, I'm still able to connect. And we are failing repeatedly, constantly to just acknowledge that, that there's much, much more communication possible than mainstream psychiatry acknowledges. And that's when people are in their most challenged place.
Which brings up to a question. I want to go back to your brother, if you don't mind me asking about him again, is there must have been a time where maybe the first time or maybe a different time where it was like put away serious. Everybody in the family knew it. It was very serious. And I'm wondering, like, now that you observe back at that time, what do you think he needed? I'm assuming he didn't get it, but what did he need?
Right. So he and I talk about that all the time. I think he would say he needed someone who wouldn't completely discount the ideas that he had, who would slow down and listen. And he actually, ironically enough, to some degree found this the second time he was locked up in a very unlikely place, because he was in a state hospital, was really run down. It was kind of your worst caricature of, you know, the decrepit state hospital where people are forgotten. But he actually ran into a psychiatrist there who, although that psychiatrist urged him to go back on medication, my brother would not, also had some things to say that let my brother know that he was heard. And this part, when I do readings, I can barely get through without choking up. So my brother leaves that psych ward. He's been arrested. And then he winds up in a homeless shelter. And his way of thinking of it is this: look, anyone on the outside would see me lining up for that free church basement food. Anyone on the outside would have seen me taking my one shirt to the shower every day to wash it and think, this person is very, very, very down on his luck. But my brother says, I didn't feel down on my luck because I knew, no matter how long this took, I was moving away from what I felt was the imprisonment of this diagnosis.
There's a moment in your book, I think it's the Staten Island ferry, but there's a moment where you and your brother are on a ferry and he starts dancing. And I think it's later on in the book. It's like he's already gone through a lot of things. And I read that like three times in a row. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Could you read that?
Sure. I'll read a little bit. Just to set it up, I just need people to picture, he's wearing a military khaki colored jumpsuit in combination with some little black Capizio dance shoes. The impact of the rough water against the bow created a steady, emphatic beat, and above that, the engine delivered not only a churning rhythm, but something bordering on a melody, deep and ancient, like a Gregorian chant. It was a small part of my brother's gift that he both heard this music of water and machinery and allowed himself to be inspired and electrified by it. He lifted one foot to knee height, then leapt high off the other and landed on the first foot so that there was a simultaneous vaulting and transferring of weight, followed by a reversal and more repetition back and forth, melded with the strivings of his torso and arms, amounting to movements at once airborne and sinuous. To the few passengers who watched from their cars, his mix of military jumpsuit and elfin shoes may have looked odd, compounding the oddity of his dancing, but all of this strangeness was countered by the broad solidity of his body and by his resistance to the sporadic lurching of the boat, which should have pitched him off balance and made him grab at the chain poles or brace himself against a car, but never did. He hung in the air, stomped his heels on the steel deck, sprang from side to side, spun and elevated again, athletic, animalistic, ethereal, impelled by the pulse of the water and the echoes of medieval worship. And soon, he was on a psychiatric ward with a heavy dose of Haldol seeping into his brain.
Sorry. Anyway, give me 1 second, okay? Well, first, thank you for writing that. I think that when I read the book, one, I realized you love your brother, and that's beautiful. But also, I think you were celebrating people who are mentally ill. And in that moment in that book, I was prescribed that medication once, and I think I was probably acting a little, quote unquote, out of control before I was given it, and then I was quelled, right? And became part of good society. You spent so much time with your brother writing this book. What does he think of it? What did he think of a passage like that? Did he make fun of you, or did he like it? What do you think?
Well, first, thanks. I mean, I'm glad we connected over that passage, because it's so important to me, important to my brother. I think he appreciated that I was trying to see, feel, hear my way into his way of seeing and feeling and creating. And he was creating, right?
Right.
I mean, yes, he was outside the bounds of social comportment. I mean, he was dancing on a ferry deck. But there were at least a couple times when he did this, and I was there for one of them. And I remember, you know, I'm sadly much more conventional, and a part of me was a little embarrassed, but a part of me was kind of in awe because he'd been inspired.
Yeah.
And I was just a bystander to that inspiration.
I know this is a dangerous question, and I've been asked this question a number of times in my life. I'm very manic inside of my mental illness, which means, you know, I'm a white straight guy who's manic. You can get a lot done in the world, even though you're tired at the end of it. Is mental illness, is it a gift?
Well, I wouldn't even use the word illness.
All right, see, there
would,
you go. Right?
I would go a little more radical.
Go for it.
One of the things that shook me was the frequency with which some psychiatrists, certainly not all, were unable to see that.
Amen.
So once, I'll give you an example. You know, I was invited to a little kind of salon soiree, and all very ego-affirming for me. We were going to talk about one of my books. And it happened that there were several psychiatrists at that table. And this psychiatrist said rather proudly, I almost never see a patient for whom I don't prescribe medication. And so I said, let's take Hemingway just for an example. Here's your trade-off. And I know, I said to the psychiatrist, I know this is a little soft mark and simplistic, but here's the question. You can have a couple of the greatest novels in American literature and some of the greatest stories in American literature, but have your patient kill himself at age 60. Or you can medicate that patient, because a lot of people think retrospectively Hemingway was bipolar.
Sure.
You can medicate that patient from the time he's 20, but you are likely going to sacrifice those great works of literature. He's not going to quite produce at that level. And what struck me was this psychiatrist didn't even pause. He just said, of course, I would medicate. And I'm thinking the opposite. I'm thinking, look, I'm right around that age. I'm thinking, you give me that trade-off, I will end sadly and devastatingly as the trade-off for having written art at that level. Now, again, this is simplistic, but it just shows you something about that worldview that wants to control, and control and creation, kind of opposite forces.
That was Daniel Bergner, author of The Mind and the Moon, My Brother's Story, The Science of Our Brains, and The Search for Our Psyches, talking with Charles Monroe Kane.